Thank you very much. I'm Vic Schoenbach. I'd like to give out my advertiser. Some of you have received this already. One of the websites particularly, which is called, Social Justice and Equality, and the slides that I have are on that webpage. So I'm certainly going to agree with many of the things, if not everything, that Kemi and Cleo have talked about. So just a few couple of quick things to wake us up. Maybe you haven't seen this ad when you were younger. For a better start in life, start COLA earlier. Or maybe you'd like to know how television benefits your children. So why do these things appear in mass media? How are they compatible with health? Who is financing them? So very quick outline. What makes us healthy or unhealthy? Something about the movement to document and eliminate health disparities, adapting to the complexity of reality, and then what I'm calling epidemiology for enlightenment. That is my department, after all. So what makes for health? No big surprises here. Physical security, safety, air, water, food, environment, nutrition, physical activity, immunizations, public health, healthcare, education, economic resources, social support, opportunities. That's all I need to say about that. In 1985, a report came out from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. It provided the first official recognition that I'm aware of what were called excess deaths among minorities. And they said in the report they actually had very little data on any group other than African Americans, any minority group other than African Americans. So I think the 60,000 may have been for African Americans. And there were eight main recommendations, and this was back in 1985, and it included this statement, despite the unprecedented explosion in scientific knowledge and the phenomenal capacity of medicine to diagnose, treat, and cure disease, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, and those of Asian, Pacific Islander heritage have not benefited fully or equitably from the fruits of science or from those systems responsible for translating and using health sciences technology. That was 1985. It could have been written yesterday.
Yeah.
There were a number of initiatives that followed that report. NIH in 1990 created an Office of Minority Programs. 3 years later, Congress passed the Health Revitalization Act, and NIH created the Office of Research on Minority Health. In 1997, President Clinton issued an apology for the Tuskegee study of syphilis, untreated syphilis in black men. In about that year, APHA and the Department of Health and Human Services launched a joint campaign to eliminate racial and ethnic health disparities. And in 2000, Congress passed the Minority Health and Health Disparities Research and Education Act, elevating the Office of Research on Minority Health to a center. And so you see there is action and things are moving forward. In 2000, Healthy People 2010, the national planning document for public health, had two overarching goals. The second one was to eliminate health disparities. So finally, we have arrived. There was a trans NIH strategy, which was a primary goal of the law that I had just referred to, is to ensure that NIH health disparities research be an integrated and inclusive field of study rather than an aggregate of independent research activities in separate research domains. Just what we would hope for. All 27 NIH institutes and centers developed strategic plans during the following years, and they were all integrated and so on. In 2006, so a few years later, the Institute of Medicine examined the NIH Health Disparities Research Plan, and they mentioned a number of things. I won't read them all to you, but one of them, of course, is budget not allocated and need more staffing and need more trans NIH coordination. Then, fast forwarding a little bit to Healthy People 2010, so another decade has gone by, and we still have the goal to eliminate health disparities. It's now number two of four goals rather than two, so that's probably not a major advance, and it brings in health equity because that sounds better than eliminating health disparities. And so in 2013, a review of Healthy People 2010 was published. And let me pause on this one for a moment. So here are changes in health disparities from the baseline for Healthy People 2010. And this is the line for race and ethnicity. So across this line, there were 169 objectives with measurable indicators. Of those, for 117, there was no change, basically. For the others, There were two that increased, seven where the disparity decreased substantially, two where it increased substantially, five where it decreased in the middle, two where it increased, five where it increased in the middle, and then 15 and 18. And so basically, not a whole lot of progress for the 10 years, notwithstanding whatever was being done. Okay, so very quickly about what is race, since you already heard about what race is not. Biological races do not exist in humans. It's socially constructed. Joseph Graves, we had a webcast in 2006 where Joseph Graves presented that. Here are two of his books, excellent books. I think at least one was a New York Times bestseller, The Emperor's New Clothes. Race is the new Emperor's New Clothes. Great viewing if you have the time to take a look at California Newsreel's Race, the Power of an Illusion. It's a very a fascinating presentation of the evidence for this position. What really makes a difference is poverty. Race does make a difference, but it's not biological. It's race as socially implemented makes a difference, and it makes a difference biologically. Poverty is also very bad for our health. The documentary Unnatural Causes, also from California Newsreel, a series where they very eloquently present and demonstrate, talking to some of the major figures in the field, people like David Williams and others. And now, just recently out, The Raising of America talks about the upbringing of children and how disparities are built in to life at the very beginning. This is being streamed free on the web through April 15th, so this week you can still watch it on the web. There are 5 episodes, highly recommended. So what about at NIH? So we had the strategic plans in the earlier part of the century. Later on in the century, they were updated. So a new research plan, new budget, and health disparities persist. They persist across a broad spectrum. They're a concern for the nation. They're costing us billions and billions of dollars. And they're shaped by the interaction of social environmental behavior on biological factors. The money figure is new. The rest of it has been said in earlier reports. And there are more reports that I'm not including, but they say substantially the same thing from year to year. So in 2010, the Institute of Medicine had a workshop. Health disparities are not going away. Economic hardship is an important contributor. Racism persists. Residential segregation is important. There are low levels of awareness among the American public. Federal agency policies are related to, besides the ones that are specifically related to health, other federal agency policies contribute. And the Affordable Care Act hopefully will help. 2012, the Institute of Medicine issued another report. Probably running low on time. Notice the last item, how do we create political will? So what is missing? This is from David Satcher, who was a Surgeon General and heads an institute at the Morehouse College of Medicine. In order to eliminate disparities in health, we need leaders who care enough, know enough, will do enough, and are persistent enough. And the implication is we haven't had them. But I question whether we can centrally plan away health disparities. All aspects of life affect health, and we don't understand any aspect fully. All actions have multiple causes and multiple effects. There are direct effects and indirect effects. There are effects that occur in the immediate present, effects that occur long afterwards, effects that occur in the people we're looking at, effects that occur in the other people, and so on. Complexity is enormous. We never really fully address it. And different people have different views. And different people are affected differently, so it's not surprising they will have different views. We can't all agree, and there's really nobody in charge. You can make up these plans and all that sort of stuff, but who's going to follow them? Behavior is fundamental. Health disparities arise from, and they're maintained by behavior. Personal behavior, yes. Expressive behavior, what our presidential candidates say, for example. Professional behavior, what people do they treat these people or not? What do they do with respect to taking care of individuals in various other professions, your lawyer, your accountant, your et cetera, et cetera. Economic behavior, what do corporations do, has an enormous impact on health disparities. Political behavior has an enormous effect on health disparities. Who's studying these? Who's determining what influences these behaviors? So I don't have time to go into this. I really can't fully, I'm not qualified to go into it fully, but let me throw out a few things to give you some flavors. So brains change. The brain is not fixed at birth. The brain is plastic and it develops during life. And it develops in response to all sorts of environmental stimuli, both biological stimuli and also social stimuli, environmental stimuli, and so on. So child abuse alters the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal stress responses and suicide risks. So early child abuse, which is something that is certainly differently experienced by children in different groups, alters the brains of the children who experience it. Comparisons of suicide victims with and without a history of child abuse found decreased levels of and differences in glucocorticoid receptor messenger RNA in the brain. So the brain is permanently changed, or at least it changed in a lasting fashion. I don't want to say it can't go back, but it's changed in a lasting fashion. And the epigenetic regulation of hippocampal glucocorticoid receptor expression changes. So that means that these children are going to respond differently to the same situation as children who haven't experienced abuse. That means when they go to early preschool, if they have it, when they go to regular school, they'll be reacting differently in ways that will not necessarily be helpful to them. Here's another area of exposure. This is kind of long, but it's a very interesting study. This was a study that took popular television programs, extracted very short segments from them, removed the audio, and removed the main character in the scene. So what was left in this video was a group of people interacting with the main character whom you don't see. Some of those main characters were African American, other of those main characters were white. Then these videos were shown to people like you and they were asked to rate, what do these people think about this main character whom they can't hear, they can only watch them. Americans are exposed via television to nonverbal race bias. And such exposure can influence perceivers' race associations and self-reported racial attitudes. Nonverbal behavior that communicates favoritism of one race over another can be so subtle that even across a large number of exposures, perceivers are unable to consciously identify the nonverbal pattern. Yet, despite or perhaps because of this subtlety, exposure to nonverbal race bias may transmit race bias to perceivers. This was in Science, the reference is there, and these slides are on the web. Here's another one about the changes in the brain and the response of the brain. We think, but we actually are doing things besides thinking with our brains. So hormones alter emotional states, such as fear. They bias attention, for example, towards sexual stimuli versus other stimuli. They change the pleasantness or aversiveness of stimuli, such as infant odors. They alter behavioral probabilities in ways that depend on prior experience. And the basic endocrine mechanisms and brain structures have been remarkably conserved in the course of evolution. So this is not something that humans come up with. This is our animal forebears have bequeathed this to us. Habitual actions require less mental effort than actions that are selected to achieve an outcome. But habitual actions must be inhibited if the situation changes. So if somebody says something to me that ordinarily would provoke me to get angry, but the situation is one where anger really won't work, I hope to be able to inhibit my angry response and take a response that will be more useful positively. When rats are subjected to chronic stress, they become less sensitive to changes in outcomes. They don't become aware of them as much. So the chronic stress causes structural changes in the brain that may bias toward habit and dysfunctional decision making. There again, people who've grown up in situations where they've been under stress may not react as effectively in situations later. Here's just a study which shows that cognitive performance declines when people work long hours constantly. For a long time, it was generally assumed that many of the mental processes that make goal pursuit possible require consciousness. But in the past decade or so, the scientific study of goal pursuit has discovered that these processes can also operate without conscious awareness, and hence human behavior may originate in a kind of unconscious will. We may not be what we think we are. Can consciousness be improved? I think so. Transcendental meditation, check out the DavidLynchFoundation.org. I've got a link there to a video on the Quiet Time program. It's making a huge impact in the schools where it's been implemented. Can epidemiologists evaluate a holistic intervention with a long-term impact? This is an article about the Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine, where they now have an elective course for their medical students on transcendental meditation. and 40 of their faculty, the medical school faculty, have now learned to practice TM in a study of burnout. So this is getting acceptance in fairly respectable places. This is the David Lynch Foundation's website. They have programs for schools in disadvantaged neighborhoods, for veterans suffering from PTSD, for women who've been victims of domestic violence, for American Indian tribes, people in homeless shelters and prisons. And there are some remarkable studies. Many of them are published, but most of the published studies are fairly small. But there are very impressive results. So let me invite your comments for all of the speakers, of course. But let me just point out that I have a lot more on these themes. A lot more on these themes at this website here, which is on the one that says social justice and equality. My YouTube channel has interviews with lots of people, some of whom you will find interesting. They're webcasts at UNC Minority. And coming up June 7th is our next webcast. So thank you very much.
Cheers on the stage if you guys want to sit up there so everybody can hear you. We have a little bit of time for questions. I'm going to jump in first because that's my, I get to do that. So one of the things that I find really challenging in research, I'm going to turn the display off, is that we have these things where we say race is not biological, it's a social construct, and we know it's not a binary, but when you're doing research, we have to condense these things into being a binary, kind of across all disparities. We have to say what we think poor is, and what we think black is, and what we think even gender, what we think, you know, where we draw the line between what we say when we're measuring these things. For the purposes of research, we have to say, we're going to go self-reported race, you are black, you are white, these are the only options. So how do you have thoughts on how you handle that in your research, or how you think that could be handled? Is there a better way to do it than the way we do it now?
So, I mean, I think that as the least qualified person on the panel, I'll speak for you. I mean, I really think it depends on what your question is. So, I mean, I think that, you know, you're doing, for example, I just went to a national conference where somebody stood up and presented research about the genetic underpinnings of racial disparities in ovarian cancer. And essentially, he had self-reported race, black and white, and then redefined race as white was greater than 90% European ancestry and black was greater than 80% African ancestry. That's like a whole conversation in and of itself. You need less black to be black? Okay. And then he looked for like specific markers of doing poorly in ovarian cancer and basically was like, oh, so this is why people aren't doing well, because this ancestry confers more of a risk, etc. So, I mean, I think like that was one way where you can't just use, like, he was trying to do something other than just using categories of black and white, and he did it very poorly. But in that sense, then I think that you need to get into more, something that's more specific. However, on the other hand, I know that there's this push, like, you can't just make people categories, but when there are systemic differences in treatment based on those categories, they have validity to study. So, I mean, like, if self-reported race has, like, makes a difference in whether or not you get surgery, it really bothers me that then people want to study surgery and say, but you can't use these categories of race. We have to adjust them away, when that's clearly a driving factor. So it's actually exactly what you said. Like, race is socially constructed, and we react to that social construction. So I do think that there's space to study it as it is socially constructed, if you understand what you're doing. So I think it depends, I guess, is like my main answer. It really becomes problematic in genetics when people try to use it in these broad strokes.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it's important. I think it just depends on your question, certainly. And what I do, I am interested in these systemic factors and how one is perceived by their provider in the system and how that perception impacts a patient's course of care. I always advocate for use of self-reported race because there's just these differences in terms of how one perceives a person and what they really say they are. However, I think it's, I haven't done this, but I think it would be interesting to look at differences according to what a patient reports and what the provider or whomever's intaking the patient, what they document. Because truly, these inequities that we observe, they're happening because of how a person is perceived by the system. So if they are, if an individual is perceived as a Latino male, then there's this whole process, this whole trajectory that's going to occur as far as like their care because of how they're perceived by the system. But if they identify as white, which is also possible, white and not necessarily identifying with their Latino origins, that has also a different set of implications. So I think it'd be interesting to actually look at both. I haven't seen a study that has done this, but I think that we definitely need to do a better job of documenting patient self-reported race. Because oftentimes what we see in the medical records or what we see, the data that's presented, now I'm not even going to talk about Medicare and how Medicare, the data on race on Medicare is just, that's coming from Social Security, and that's a whole other story about how those data are collected. But we don't collect race specific information or data on race in a systematic fashion, and that has implications for how we document and measure racial disparities. So, but everything you said, ditto.
I think, and as a student, I think it goes back to what the level of quality, like the level of rigor we put into questions of race. So it's like any other variable in your data set where you want to know how accurate it is, etc., you bring that same rigor. So you're like, yes, race is in my data set. Yes, it's like a, it's a three-level variable, which is trash. And yes, there have been these studies that have shown that this is the relative accuracy of this. Like, that's where I think we're also just missing, where it's just assumed to be something simple that doesn't have to be investigated with the same rigor that you would sit there and you would cite 10 references for how the income was derived, or you would cite 10 references for the regionalization,
but or do five sensitivity analysis with this,
somehow for race, we're just like, oh, black, white, other, done. And that's what we need to change so we can get like better research and better answers.
Right.
I would agree. I don't think you need to have anything more for me.
Great. Other questions? Yeah,
well, my first question was already answered, just about increasing the standard. I think you all just answered in that last piece, so thank you for that. But understand that everyone has their own specific research interests, and we often research in silos. But when we're compiling research and doing literature reviews, it's very interdisciplinary. We're looking at other journals and these types of things. So I was wondering, what would be one thing that you would like to see in every article, kind of, sort of, just to help get more at this health equity piece? Because, you know, it's bigger than just, you know, focusing on race sometimes in an article. Like, those aren't the only articles that we should find health equity information or discriminatory information in. So, hopefully, if my question is clear, like, what will be one thing that it will be very beneficial for all articles to at least display to help push forward this mission of health equity?
Okay. Okay, you look first. I think one of the things that I'm looking for is more details and methods, for example, and background, like an intro on the methods on how they conceptualize race and why with regards to their specific question. I think going back to what you said, Kemi, it's just, here's all the covariates that we adjusted for, race, this, that, and the other, but there's no discussion on how it was conceptualized. There's often very little discussion on the source of the race measure, or if you're not looking at race, if you're interested in other types of inequities, the source of your measure of interest, the validity of that particular measure, also your approach to measuring that particular inequity, and then the limitations of that approach. So really being critical of how you're evaluating these inequities, but also being very transparent in how you're measuring it, why, the relevance for your question. I think that would really push the needle in terms of health equity. My hope is that that's on the one hand in terms of the papers, but I think there also needs to be, sorry, I'm going to give you a response to a different question, but I also think that there needs to be more of a critical eye coming from the reviewers as well to ask these questions as well, to really push researchers to be very transparent in terms of how they've measured these different these different factors. So I think just more transparency in the conceptualization, the measurement, and then the limitations, along with the implications of their findings, I think would be really important.
So I think kind of in broad strokes, in the world of health services research, which is very broad, but really is, you know, it's all about trying to understand the healthcare system and how people enter. And I don't think that you can publish health services research studies about how people do in the healthcare system and not include race, when like the healthcare system is an institution in this country that is, that has systemic racism built into it, just like the criminal justice system. Like, could you imagine publishing data on the criminal justice system and not having race? People would be like, how do we even, what does this mean? But in health, we do that, and it makes no sense. So I think when you're looking at that, that's gotta be a piece of it. I would also add, I mean, I would echo what she said about like how you're using it. I think this is so simple, but literally, if you're going to be publishing something on racial disparities, I would like a breakdown of the numbers in each group, the covariate numbers in each group. And this sounds stupid, but like Cancer, which is a pretty high journal in our field, just published this paper. It's called like Racial Disparities and Where Patients, in Patients' Prediction of End of Life, Their Accuracy and How Accurate They Are. I talked to you about this already. But basically, you know, and it was basically the punchline was Black people are less accurate about how long they're gonna live than white people. And this was the punchline. Okay, well, first of all, 70% of all the patients were inaccurate, and about 70% of doctors are inaccurate. So, like, that's one. And then two, there were 200 white patients from 9 different sites around the country. There were 30 Black patients, almost all from Texas. This is cancer. I mean, this was published in the Journal of the American Cancer Society and tweeted out as a headline. And like, I know we're repeating ourselves, but to answer your question, yeah, quality, like literally just quality. But you had to go and read the paper to find out that that's how bad it was. And so I think those kind of like table ones, like really basic stuff, a power analysis, and then a reason why you conceptualize that there would be this much of a difference by race with citations. You know, again, just like raising the level of rigor about the research will change, I think, our conclusions and then what we decide we have to do something about and what we don't. Yeah, so
I think the addition that I would recommend would be racial ethnic diversity in the editorial board of all the journals. I'm serious. Because I think with all of these different things, it's not a question of methods or techniques. It's a question of who is making the judgments about them, who's evaluating them.
Critically evaluating, absolutely.
I think, tragically, that may be all the time we have. Yeah, it's 1:30. So I don't want to keep anybody later than promised. So thank you guys all so much for coming, and thank you guys so much to our panels.
And I'm happy if you have questions, you can email me.
I'll rant about this all
day. I'll listen to you guys rant about this.
Thanks,
Jennifer. Yeah, this was so great.
Thank you.
I'm sorry
you're
last
time I was at the PHA, when I was just walking
through
one of the big, I don't know, halls there, so...
I didn't mention to you that